In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Stevens Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me is singer, guitarist, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Ricky Bird. He was active in Joan Jett of the Blackhearts for over a decade, contributing to the songwriting and touring. From there, he went on to play with Roger Daltrey and lots of other greats. He also embarked on a solo career. His latest single is Glandemic Blues, out now on Wicked Cool Records. It's a recent coolest song in the world, and we'll hear some of it now. Afterwards, I'll be back with Ricky for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. In Little Stevens Underground Garage.
One Saturday night. Hey life, when did you get back in town? It's been strictly Dullesville since you ain't been around. Things have changed, but you knew that all along, didn't you? But cut to the chase, all used to be is gone. I know we'll get right eventually. It feels like an eternity. I'm a patient man, but this one's for the books. I'm hungry for some nightlife and the good times that you took. Since I took you for a spin, I'm chomping at the bit to get back in the game. I could use a little bit of different, 'cause every day's pretty much the same. Hey life, I'm talking to you. All due respect, why do you do the things you do? And it's not so perfect world, we're all just trying to have our say. It's hard enough without those.
Here with you in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and my guest for our coolest conversations today is Ricky Bird, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, along with other members of Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. He's also known as the Recovery Troubadour, and he's played with a who's who list of greats, including Roger Daltrey, Ian Hunter, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Joe Walsh, Alice Cooper, Dion, and many others. His new single, Glandemic Blues, is out on Wicked Cool Records, and it's this week's coolest song in the world. How are you, Ricky?
I'm doing fabulous, Manfred. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm always very happy to chat with you. You know, let's see, the first time we spoke was back in 2017. Now, do you remember that?
Of course. How could I forget talking to the Mighty Manfred?
Oh, I tell you what. That sounds so good. Yeah, I was going to say the thing about Honey and Flies, but you know, you caught me a long time ago. So when we first spoke, that was when you covered that the Kicks, the Paul Revere and the Raiders tune,
right?
The album Clean Getaway.
And then we spoke again in 2020 about the album at that time. But one thing I was wondering, I don't think we've really focused on before, is just like some of your backstory. Like, I know you grew up in the Bronx,
yes,
or Flushing, or both, or where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bronx. I mean, I was born in the Bronx and lived there until I was about 13 and a half. Then we moved to Queens, New York.
Okay.
And then to the city, and, you know, so I've been to most of the boroughs at this point. Yeah, I'm a New York guy, you know.
Well, what got you playing guitar?
Oh, well, that's an easy one. And anybody in my demographic, you'll probably hear the same thing. I saw the Beatles and the Stones on the Ed Sullivan Show, you know. I was like 9 years old. And I saw it first. I think I saw the Beatles first. And, of course, my house was filled with music. I mean, I could close my eyes and picture myself on the roof of our apartment building in the Bronx, which we called, of course, Tar Beach. You know, and I'd be on a blanket. My mother would be playing like cards with her friends, like with a little card table. You could see Yankee Stadium, you know, from our building.
Yeah.
And I'd always have a transistor radio. So I was listening to the wonderful New York radio that we had back then, AM radio. And the music back then, not the music back then, but the stations back then, AM, they would play, not unlike Little Steven's Underground Garage. They would play, you know, Al Green, into the Stones, into Trini Lopez, into, you know, Sam Cooke, into... So when I was a very little kid, I got to hear a lot of different styles of music and soak all that up. And then of course we had the Ed Sullivan Show, so that everybody would sit around the TV on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock and watch. And Ed would bring these, you know, it was a variety show. So he had comedy and jugglers and like the cast of a New York show, or. And then he would bring on rock and roll musicians, of course, the Beatles and Elvis, the famous Elvis show that he was on, where they shot him from the waist up.
And let me ask you something about, you described this pretty idyllic moment being there on the, as you call it, the Tar Beach, and your mom's got the card table out. Did you say you were actually playing guitar?
I'm like 9 years old and I see the Beatles. I was talking about how my music like was always in my life because I listened to it with my little transistor radio. And when I was nine, I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show and then the Stones. And of course I love the Beatles. But when I saw the Stones, something else clicked, you know. I was like, oh, that looks dangerous. I like that, you know. And I asked my mom for an acoustic guitar. I asked my mom for a guitar, and sometime later, I can't remember the timeline. My mom's boss, she worked at a handbag company in New York, and my mom's boss gave her an acoustic guitar to give to me for my birthday.
Oh.
And it's a little, you know, little, and funny enough, I kept it all along. It's in the Rock Hall now, believe it or not. I had this little acoustic, no name acoustic. But I was able to figure out stuff off the radio, not well, but, you know, I had a knack to pick up riffs and stuff like that. In fact, in my school, public school, PS 73 on Anderson Avenue in the Bronx, one day I brought my guitar into school and I played badly, probably. I stood in front of the class and played Happy Together by the Turtles. And probably because it had that riff, you know, that was easy to learn by. Down, 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 you know. So, yeah, I've been playing since I'm nine. And I'm working up to learning my fourth chord, which is good.
well, you only need three.
Right.
And so you go to school one day and you play through the Turtle song. When you were in high school, did you play in any bands?
Oh, sure. When we moved to Queens, I started to hook up with other musicians I think it even started in junior high school, but definitely when I got to high school, with other musicians. We put together, what did we put together, Manfred? We put together garage bands.
Well, by this time, you have an electric guitar?
Yes. Okay. So there was an electronics store on right near my house in Queens called Lafayette Electronics.
Okay.
And every year they put out like a big, thick sort of a book of what they sold. They sold mostly stereo stuff and this and that. Yeah. But in the back, they had all the music equipment. They had guitars. They had amps. They had little, like, you know, like sort of little PA setups. They had like lights that flashed for your shows at the teen dances that you would play and stuff. So I would always like stare at this one guitar. And at some point, and I can't remember how I got it. Either I worked at like a, you know, a day job of some sort, you know, some silly kind of paper route or something silly. And I bought this, this kind of, it looked like a Gibson ES-335, but it was, you know, it was a cheap store guitar.
Yeah.
But it was my first electric guitar, and it came with a little amp, you know, tiny, and I'm talking little amp. Which actually, I'm back to little amps again, which is funny. How you go through the whole, you come back around.
Right.
You know, if I can't pick it up with one hand, I don't want to use it. And I started playing electric guitar, you know. And like I said before, we would actually play in my friend's garage, which obviously is where the term came from. And I remember the time because it was, we were trying to play songs from Tommy. Right. So when the Who's Tommy came out.
Yeah.
So what year was that? 69? 68, 69?
Yeah.
And of course, I don't, you know, it sounds like sitting back here now, we were fabulous, but we probably were awful. and we would play like dances and stuff like that and church events and beach clubs. I mean, I remember playing a beach club in Queens doing Black Sabbath, you know, with my friends. But I started to get these friends from a different part of Queens than I was in. And they were already locked into British music. And I'm talking about Humble Pie, The Faces. Okay. You know, obviously I knew The Stones and that sort of stuff. But all of the you know, Sweet, all the stuff that I grew up loving. Slade. I love Slade. And they turned me on to all that stuff. So I remember in 1973, we played my high school, Flushing High School. And we opened up with a Humble Pie song, 4 Day Creep. We played Savoy Brown. We played Tell Mama, what's fabulous is a few years ago, I did a recovery event in Philly and Kim Simmons was playing also on that bill. And I got to play blues with Kim Simmons, who was in Savoy Brown. So that was, that was wonderful. Unfortunately he's passed since then, but what a sweet guy. And that's how it started, you know. I just started playing in bands like that and playing rock and roll in the neighborhood. And then we moved to the city. Not, I mean, the band, you know, we started playing clubs in the city, which have now become famous. The Mercer Arts Center, Max's Kansas City.
Yeah.
You know, places like that. Kenny's Castaways. And slowly but surely, we started to play originals. And that's how it started. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this.
Well, Ricky, how long did that particular band go? Because it seems like it went on for several years or not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we started probably around 72, 73. Probably went till about 74, 75, something like that. You know, different variations. People come and go, you know. Okay. You know what it's like to be in a band, right?
Not really. No.
People come and go, you know.
That's right. Well, what did you call yourselves?
Oh, let's see. I think we were called Rough Stuff at that point. Rough Stuff. Yeah, that's the one. If I could find clippings, I lost a lot of my stuff in Hurricane Sandy, but I had all the clippings from the paper that everybody read every weekend to see who was playing in New York, which is called the Village Voice. I had clippings of us playing Max's and all those joints.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I hung at Max's and. That's probably where I you know, made my rock and roll bones in that famous club. And then it led me to another band called New York Central. And they had a single out on RCA. And we actually, and I, you know, it might sound silly, but I love this part of my story is that to make money on the weekends, we would go play in the Catskills. We were the rock band at one of the Catskills hotels. So we would play, you know, we'd be playing Honky Tonk Woman and you know, Barry White, like whatever it was, whatever songs.
Right. But you would go over okay with the crowd.
Well, Yeah, we would play the, you know, the parents were in the big room listening to, you know, Jerry Vale or whoever, and we were playing to their kids.
Yeah.
And I was only, I don't know, 17 or 17, 18. But the one thing is that after our show, I love comedy and I love old school comedy. You know, I would go into the big room and I would listen to the comedians, you know, I would watch the famous Catskills comedians, and some of them, you know, you would have seen on TV, and a lot of them never even got that far, but they were incredible. And then we would go, like, the all of the talent in the Catskills, like whoever played that night, wind up in the coffee shop at 2 a.m. telling stories, which was just like Broadway Danny Rose. And it turns out that's what I do now. You sit around telling stories about the places you played, right?
Right. Well, that's good, though. That's why I'm asking you. That's why we're talking.
Yeah,
so how did you, you're doing that, and that must have seemed like those guys, they had a right. You said they had a single out on RCA when you joined them?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that must have seemed like, hey, man, I'm hitting the big time here.
Yeah, yeah. And then we tried to get a deal, and we didn't get a deal. And, you know, we kept working it and kept doing those gigs upstate. And then little by little, I wound up, you know, long story short, I wound up in a band called Susan, which my wife introduced me to Tommy Mottola, because she was friends with him for a long time before the music business. And he signed us to a production deal. And Susan was a band that came from Boston, moved down to New York. Uh-huh. And there's a hard to find blue vinyl record out there somewhere, the Susan record that we put out. So we got signed to RCA, again RCA.
You're right.
This time we were actually on RCA. And we actually did a tour we recorded a record in New York, and then we went on the road. We toured with Graham Parker and The Rumor. That was my first tour.
Oh, that's cool.
Across the country, which was great. And then when that band, you know, kind of fell apart after one album, which often happens again, you know, we tried to keep it alive. People left. We tried to keep it alive. But then we kind of moved on. And I went on the road. G.E. Smith was also, he played with Hall & Oates back then, right? And Hall & Oates was managed by Tommy Mottola. So G.E. said, my band was finished, and G.E. was leaving Hall & Oates. He says, look, I put a record out. You want to go on tour with me as the second guitar player? I said, yeah, sure. And we did a national tour opening for Squeeze.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So far, pretty good company, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I came back to New York and then trying to figure out what to do next. And I started hanging out with Steve Marriott, who, of course, Humble Pie was one of my favorite bands. And
right.
Steve was managed by Lieber Krebs, where my wife Carol was a publicist. And she introduced me to Steve, knowing, you know, he was my one of my favorite singers back then.
Yeah.
We started hanging out, and also John Waite just left the Babies, and he moved to New York, and somebody hooked us up, and we were hanging out, thinking of doing something together. And then one day Carol said to me, did you ever hear of Joan Jett? I'm like, of course. She said, would you like to go down and play with her in the studio? I said, yeah. So I went down and I played with Joan, and wound up joining the band.
And you were playing there with her for, that was well over a decade, and then
it was like 81,
then, right?
81 to 91.
Yeah.
And then I came back and I did a VH1 special with her, a one-off.
Yeah.
And then I haven't, you know, seen her in ages. And then I saw her at the Rock Hall, which was unbelievable, of course. And you know, that was that. That was an amazing band to be in. We traveled the world. I mean, look, Manfred, I got to do what I wanted to do when I was 13.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all I have is gratitude for it. And now I'm doing my own stuff. And I also, what's great about my career is I get to do these events as part of these great all-star bands. So, you know, when you were introducing me, you know, played with this one. Yeah, I was in a band with Joan. I toured with Ian Hunter. I did a record with Roger Daltrey and did a tour with Roger. I did a short tour with John Waite, and all the cool people that are on my bio, I got to share the stage with, because I've in these house bands, you know, at the Rock Hall or, you know, charity events around the country, backing up all these cool people like Mavis Staples and Brian Wilson and, you know, Smokey Robinson, and just go, the list is like ridiculous. Alice, of course, Alice Cooper. So I'm a pretty lucky guy. Yeah, I have a pretty wide range stretch in my career of what I do.
I was going to ask, out of all these folks you have worked with and come in contact with, and we know they're all great, but was there anybody that just sort of exceeded your wildest expectations to where afterwards you're like, man, this is, I really am in the presence of complete greatness.
Dude, playing in my room with Brian Wilson.
Oh, wow.
Or playing I'll Take You There with Mavis Staples, or playing, I'm 18 with Alice. Yeah. I mean, it's my childhood, right? And you get to play with all these, of course, playing with Roger Daltrey. Let's not forget playing all the young dudes with Ian Hunter and touring with them, and playing all the songs that I learned when I was a 14-year-old. I've had a really fabulous career. I mean, dude, I got to play in a little club when the Blackhearts were playing in Memphis. After the show, we went to a little club and Rufus Thomas was playing. And I remember Kim from the T-Birds, the fabulous T-Birds, was singing and playing harp. Uh-huh. And Kim said, hey, man, you want to jam a song with us? I got to do Walking the Dog with Rufus Thomas. Come on, man.
All right.
Come on.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. So, last we spoke was in 2020, and we were talking about that time your solo album, Sobering Times, and we talked a lot about your efforts as the recovery troubadour. Now you've got a new single on Wicked Cool Records. It's our coolest song in the world this week, Glendemic Blues. What led you to sign with Wicked Cool? How did you line that up?
Well, first of all, I did those two. I'm a person in long-term recovery, okay? And I did those two records, Clean Getaway and Sobering Times. Straight up, straight up rock and roll, but it had a message of recovery. Not preaching, it was just kind of laying the cards on the table. So when it came time to start writing new stuff, I said, you know what, I did that now. I have enough songs to last for quite a while, that recovery theme songs. Let me just write some cool rock and roll stuff. But let me try to write stuff that I've never written before, themes that I've never written before. And I just started writing stuff. And of course, we were all stuck in our house for a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
And the riff to Glendemic Blues came. The title came last. And I just started writing the lyrics to it. And it's about being frustrated. And it's actually me having a conversation with life. Look where we are. I know it'll turn out okay eventually, but, and the chorus is, give me one Saturday night. Like, just, man, I'm just dying to go out. Like, I'm sure you went through this. Everybody went through the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, what I wanted to ask you is, what did you do last Saturday night?
Well, it turns out now that we could go out, I still wind up sitting watching Godfather of Harlem or something. But it's the fact that you couldn't go out that made it difficult.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, how do I want to put this out? And Steven has always been sort of, hey, you should be on Wicked Cool. You should be on Wicked Cool. So finally, I sent it to Dennis Mortensen, of course, and he sent Glendemic Blues. Well, I also made a plan. I had this plan as like, I'm done with albums. No more full-length records, which of course can change at any moment. Right. But I said, I just want to do singles. I'm going to be like Tommy James. Let me just do singles. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So it turns out, and you're a songwriter. When you write singles, you write differently than you're writing for an album. Now you're right. You may write album singles, but eventually there's going to be some songs that you'll go, this is not a single, but this is great for the album or the record. Yeah. What do they call it today? Is it a record, an album?
Well, we call it both those, synonymous. Yeah. With both. Yeah.
Yeah. So I keep getting, my wife keeps saying to me, what are you from 1975? It turns out I am.
And then you actually say yes. You just say yes.
Yeah. So I started writing songs that are definitely singles. I was trying to keep them under a certain time.
Yeah.
Like I have this thing. I'm trying to keep it under, 3:15, 3:20. See if I can get there. And slam it with a good chorus and just make it a lot of ear candy and just make it fun.
Yeah.
Stuff that I want to hear on the radio. So I did what I always do, and I send stuff to my pal, Michael DeBar. Like I always run, I always send him my songs. What do you think of this, bro? And I remember I sent it to him as I got out of the studio when we mixed it. I was in my car and I sent it to him. And he said, I love it. He said, but you know what you got to do? You got to start with the chorus. I went, okay, so I actually put a small heaping of the chorus at the top of the song. I said, well, that's okay. A good idea. That's good radio sense.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm always open to learning new stuff. You got to keep your mind open, you know, and some people know more than you, you know. And that's how it turned out. And then once Stephen gave it the go ahead, I had a conversation. And I said, yeah, let's do Wicked Cool. And I worked it out. So right now we're doing singles. I have a second one ready to go. And okay. I don't know, man, once I could tell you right now that I have an album's worth of tracks because you keep writing. You can't, you know, once the door opens, it's like you go through this period where you can't write anything. Like you sit down with your guitar and you go, I got nothing, you know, and eventually an idea comes. And once the idea comes, the door is open and it starts to kind of rush out and you go, oh, wow, that's a cool thing. Oh, that's a nice riff. Oh, that's a good idea. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, 10, 11 tracks and there you go. So I'm kind of just doing it one song at a time. See what we got. It's called Glamdemic Blues. That was the last, like, what do I call this thing? And it was, you know, it is about the pandemic. And it is glammy, which is part of my history.
Right.
Of the stuff that I grew up listening to. And I said, yeah, Glamdemic Blues. How about that?
Well, there's a name in the liner notes I was provided with that I recognize from Sobering Times. This guy, Bob Standers, plays the bass. And then did you produce this track with him? And can you remind us?
Me and Bob Stander, I've done ever since the even before Sobering Times, I had the album, I had the record Lifer that came out in 2013, I think it was. And I had a cool song from that also. Me and Bob, we always go out to his studio, Parcheesi Studios out in Long Island. And we have this like production language, you know, like over the years. So this is like the third record, fourth batch of songs now that we're on now. We have this language where like, I know, like, I just have to say something like, you know, that sound from that so-and-so record, can you give me that? And he dials it up, you know? So and he's an amazing musician too. He's an amazing bass player and guitar player. So we have this thing. This is what I do. I do all my stuff there. Now some might say, well, don't you want to try it with another producer or stuff? It's like, why? My records, I love my records.
Yeah.
You know, maybe somebody else would make them sound different, but like I am totally happy with what my stuff sounds like. And also, how do you build with somebody else? You got to start all over again with that language thing.
Right.
You know, so I feel that we do, and people seem to love this music and love the sounds. And I think we put a lot of cool ear candy on there for stuff. You know, Manfred, I try to put stuff guitar wise, stuff that I would have loved when I was a 13-year-old and I heard Jeff Beck or this one and that and go, what, how did he, wait, what? How did he play that? What is that? I try to do the same thing. It's like, the stuff that when you were listening when you were a kid with big headphones and something would go from left to right pan and, you know, Jimmy Page would play this riff or some that famous pre-vocal on Whole Lotta Love where you hear Robert Plant go, wait, before he actually sings it.
Uh-huh.
I like to do stuff like that because it takes me back to when I was a kid wanting to be this guy. And hopefully other people will feel the same way when they hear it.
We know I want us to talk some about the your Four Tops cover, but first I wanted to ask, in your role as the recovery troubadour, do you have any upcoming gigs lined up?
I just did a fabulous event at the City Winery about 3 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago or a month ago, with Steve Earle and Roseanne Cash and something my friend Rich Pagano put on. And that was fantastic. The name Recovery Troubadour came from the fact that I would take the songs from Clean Getaway and Sobering Times, and I went around to treatment facilities around the country, and I did groups to the clients in treatment using those songs, which is how those songs came about in the first place, because I needed songs to do these groups. Of course, the lockdown and the pandemic completely stopped that. And even today, I can't go into these places because they keep having outbreaks. And obviously it's a tight, you know, they're very serious about keeping those places free from COVID.
Right.
And of course, since, you know, we're certainly in a better place than we were 2.5 years ago, but it's still there, which is what you know, Glamdemic Blues is all about, right?
Right.
And the middle bit with the guitar part, it comes in, I'm whispering, mask on, mask off, mask on, mask off.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you, do you still wear a mask when you go out to stores and stuff, or?
I do when it's correct. Look, here's the deal. This is the way I look at it. And I'm a science guy. Like, I believe stuff, you know, from seeing. And when you live amongst people that are elderly, or you know, you visit people that are elderly, or you know, you're with people that have health issues, you got to be more careful than if you just live by yourself and just were out there playing clubs and stuff. Yeah. So when I'm around people, I try to wear the mask as much as possible. You know, I've done gigs. I've been backstage, you know, at this gig at the City Winery. And, you know, there were maybe a handful of people wearing masks. Most weren't. And I was lucky. I came out clean from that. But there were people getting, you know, testing positive all the time. And yeah, for the most part, everybody just gets mild symptoms. But you could still pass it on to somebody that has health issues.
Right.
So, you know, you try to look, we're living our life. It seems like it's manageable. You got to find a balance between being paranoid and living your life.
Right.
Because you only get one, bro.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's talk some about the cover, the B-side, the Reach Out, yeah. I'll Be There. Does that tie into your working with addiction recovery?
Reach That's Out, interesting. I'll Be There. Good question. So that was for the Sobering Times record.
Okay.
And yeah, so I did Kicks on the Clean Getaway record because I wanted a cover song that would have a message. And Kicks was one of probably the first, you know, anti-drug kind of messages, I guess.
Yeah.
And also, you know, business-wise, I said, well, I bet you I'll get airplay with this one, with Kicks.
You were right.
I was right. Yeah. And then came for Sober Town. What should I do? What song should I use? And I swear, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I was sitting in my car listening to Underground Garage, and all of a sudden I hear, and I went, oh crap, that's the song. Reach Out, I'll Be There. So we recorded that, and I think I did a pretty good version of it. That beginning that I played the melody on guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting sitting back now and knowing that Jeff Beck is no longer with us, but I was absolutely aiming for a Jeff Beck vibe on that intro. You know, I mean, he's like my favorite guitar player.
Did you ever get a chance to sit in with him or meet him even?
I got to meet him. I didn't get to sit in with him. He was lovely. He was humble. He was sweet. He was funny. And in fact, when I told him, you know, how much of an influence he was on my guitar playing, he blushed.
Oh,
and right. He was just a complete cool guy. And you know, as people of my age, you can hear a little bit of blues guys, you could hear a little bit of Jimmy Page, you could hear a little bit of Clapton, you may hear a little bit of Paul Kossoff. You rarely hear a little bit of Jeff Beck in anybody. I mean, nobody played like Jeff Beck. Because
I want to add something to this when you're talking about his humbleness. So the one time I was able to, I interviewed him, and of course it was a Loud Hailer album came out, and it's like, they do these things where it's like, he goes from one outlet to the next. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's hard. You've got this time limit to just sort of develop any sort of, rapport.
Yeah, yeah.
But as typical as you get, you know, as it gets into it, then, you know, he's kind of relaxing. But I shared this story with him that I had heard that, and I asked him if he knew about this, where before Hendrix goes to the UK, he's talking to Randy California about how he's going to take him with him, and they're going to go track down Jeff Beck because he wants to check out Jeff Beck.
Yes.
And so I thought of that because Beck was talking about how much he was enamored of Hendrix and how blown away he was. And I asked him, were you aware of this story? And it was apparent that he wasn't. And so I shared the story with him. And you could just sense from on the other end that he was just, you know, he'd never heard it before. And he was really just sort of overwhelmed by it. And he thought it was so great. I can totally visualize him blushing in front of you when you were sharing, you know.
He was a rock star, but he was a guitar man, you know, he was a guitar man, like this Elvis song goes, right? And he played like from the different part of his brain, like his choice of notes, where he came from, you know? And of course, if you listen to like when I grew up on the album Truth or any of those, his blues licks was like out of this world, but he got, you know, he grew out of them a little bit and he just wanted to take it further. And you just listened, even the new, even Isolation, the new song with Johnny Depp, like his guitar playing, it just amazes me. And I'll tell you one quick story. We went to see him at the Iridium, right? Carol was doing his press too. Carol, mm-hmm. my wife is a publicist. And we went to the Iridium, and you know, the Iridium Club was a very small club in Manhattan. It was Les Paul's home for, you know, 20 years or something.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, it's a small club, and every guitar player in New York was there. Like sure. you just looked around, you had everybody, Brian Setzer and this one and that one. And I swear I was sitting maybe 10 feet from him on stage. Right. And I was sitting next to Meatloaf. Right. I can't remember what song it was. It might've been, you know, a Beatles song, you know, how Jeff would do all these great covers.
Yeah.
I started crying. Right. And I kind of jabbed Meatloaf. I said, dude, I'm fucking weeping. Oops, excuse me. I'm weeping. And Meatloaf said, I've been crying since he picked up the guitar. I mean, not many people move me. Like Paul Kossoff does that to me when he sings, when I hear him live. It's to this day. But his guitar playing, he just hits notes. There must be some sort of science behind it. He hits some notes that just go straight to your heart.
Yeah.
And, you know, God bless him. I was stunned when that happened, but you know, we have his music forever. So there you go. But in my songs, I try to, I'm always giving a nod to everything I grew up on. I'm not trying to create anything new. I'm just trying to write good songs. And I always go, let me do a little Jeff Becklick here. You know, let me do a thing here. Let me try this here. So I'm always doing a nod to the people I grew up listening to and who were influences on me.
Ricky, I want to thank you again for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you for talking to me. It's always a joy to speak with you and to catch up. And thanks for playing my songs. I hope everybody loves it. When you come to New York, baby, we'll put the feed bag on. We'll go get some New York deli.
That's what we're going to do. Right now, though, we're going to take a listen to your B-side. It's Ricky Bird with Reach Out, I'll Be There in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was Ricky Bird with his version of the Four Tops' Reach Out, I'll Be There. It's the B-side to his latest single, Glandemic Blues, out on Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Ricky for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Joy Buzzer is a power pop band from New York City. Their latest single, Judy, 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 is out now on Wicked Cool Records, and we'll be joined next time around by band member Jed Becker to find out all about it. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Bye, Daddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.